The Case and Cure of a Deserted Soul by Joseph Symonds. The Case and Cure of a Deserted Soul was originally published in London in 1653. This digital Puritan reprint, in which grammar, spelling, and minor formatting changes have been made, is copyright 2012 by Gerald Mick, all rights reserved. Follow the Digital Puritan on Facebook or Twitter. Please address email correspondence to info@digitalpuritan.net. Forward. Much of what claims the title of evangelical Christianity in the 21st century will have no tolerance for Joseph Symonds. The Christ of this culture's imagination exists to enlarge our self-esteem and improve our enjoyment of, well, ourselves. There's seen no profit in pain and certainly no satisfaction in sanctification. He is no longer the soul's treasure. Indeed, he should be so lucky that we have allowed him the privilege of serving us. In this, the dumbing down of our understanding of who God is has finally come home to roost. No wonder the church is impotent. No wonder few are ever really changed, ever really freed from the paltry pleasures of sin and self. We are, as C.S. Lewis so poignantly posited, half-hearted creatures, fooling about with drink and sex and ambition when infinite joy is offered us, like an ignorant child who wants to go on making mud pies in a slum because he cannot imagine what is meant by the offer of a holiday at the sea. We have learned to be somewhat content with God's gifts, but have forgotten that those gifts are meant to point the soul to the gift giver, who is in himself a far more glorious and satisfying gift. Therefore, quite frankly, there is no category of thought that could conceive of a God who afflicts his own people. God has been relegated to the role of making us happy, healthy, wealthy, and whole. We deign to allow God to consign himself to making much of us. But what if God is more concerned with our holiness than our happiness? We have forgotten, or more likely have never been exposed to, the truth that if God were to allow anything in creation to supplant Christ as the soul's greatest good, God himself would be facilitating idolatry by slighting his own son. It is precisely at this point that Joseph Symonds confronts modern sensibilities. Symonds doggedly maintains that God is the reward, and as such, he will relentlessly pursue primacy in the affections of his people. God's end in afflicting the soul is not its pain, that it may waste itself in sighs and groans, but that it may pursue him with more eagerness. If this thesis is unintelligible or undesirable to you, Symonds' work is sure to be shunned. You can stop reading now. You're reading the wrong book. On the other hand, if you've come to thirst after God, even in your wounded state, and long for the day when sin will no longer encumber your soul with competing interests, Symonds' treatise will confront, convict, and challenge you, perhaps more deeply than anything you will ever read. The soul that has a sense of God's sweet presence cannot be satisfied without him, but counts all things nothing till it regains him who is to her as the sun is to the world, and the soul to the body. This book is far more than a simple solution to suffering. It is a map back to the buried treasure you once had, or a guide to the greatest possible pursuit if you have never had it. Symonds has left a legacy of divine love in these pages. This book should not be trifled with. It must be afforded the effort due its subject. The sanctifying work of God that results in an unquenchable desire for Jesus Christ and him alone. Read this book only if you would be rid of lesser pursuits that so easily entangle us and idle away our allotted time. In your lonely, melancholy hour, never forget that the one most afflicted, Isaiah 53 verse 4, thought it his joy to please his Father, Hebrews 12 verse 2. David, writing the psalm last on our Savior's lips before suffering the infinite wrath and desertion of God, reminds us, "The afflicted shall eat and be satisfied. Those who seek him shall praise the Lord. May your hearts live forever." Psalm 22, verse 26. 10,000 blessings in the innocent afflicted one, Dr. James Allen Fain III. Author's Preface. Accesses and recesses are not proper to him that by his immense presence fills all, and cannot be where he is not, nor cease to be where he is. True motion is only found in such things which are confined to local circumscript. Yet in this regard, God is said to come or go, to be present or absent in respect of manifestation. As the Father speaks, he comes when he is manifested and goes when he is hidden, and in respect of operation. So God is said to be where he is found working, even as we say the sun comes into a house where it shines into it. Time was when God was with all men, both by gracious manifestation and operation, and this was man's happiness. But sin has separated between God and man, and they are departed from each other. The division began from man, and though divine goodness tenders reconcilement, man will not have it. In this, man has become unhappy. He is lost as God, and knows it not. Yea, he counts his loss gain, and his gain loss. He would be happy, but errs in his choice. He is ever moving, never at rest, willingly absent from the greatest good, unwillingly laboring with the greatest evil. Though other things are quiet in their place and rest in their end, yet the place where man is pitched is strange to him, and his end vexes him. All his life is labor, and his motion is but a vexatious shifting from vanity to vanity, from evil to evil, from bad to worse. The soul cries out for healing, and that which he thinks to find as lenitive becomes corrosive. While he thinks to cure the wound, he makes it ever deeper, and is his own tormentor. The heathen blunder in confused guesses about how to redraw the state of man. They saw an unhappiness, but neither knew the cause nor the cure. Even so, they ascertained something when they propounded these two rules to repair the breach. Number one, to reduce things to the first principles of nature. Number two, to live according unto nature. These rules are useful if rectified and rightly used. First, reduce things to their primitive originals and lay them again in the womb from whence they sprang. This experiment would profit much. Look into the world and you shall see a confused mixture of good and evil, but you must divide them wisely and pursue them to their beginnings. Ascend to the scattered beams of happiness in the world, to the sun of righteousness from whence they flow, and descend by the black and bitter streams of misery to the poisoned stream that sends them forth, and you will see two originals of both: God, the fountain of life, and sin, the root of death. In the way of reduction of things to their causes, a man may see as in a glass what he was and what he should be, what made him miserable, and what would make him happy. It is man's unhappiness to choose the worst of two guides, brutishly declining reason to be led by sense, seeing, enjoying, and suffering things without inquisition into their parentage. This is true folly, to dwell in the surface of things, not penetrating into their inmost nature, utmost end, and foremost rise. A wise man sees things quite through, from first to last. He asks these questions of the things he meets with. What are you? Where are you going? Where are you coming from? He lives not like a subject to the world, but as a lord he examines and judges all things. He allows no vagrants, but keeps all in order, as the genealogies of all things, and reduces them to their several tribes. There is a certain voice in things, speaking loud and proclaiming the cause to which they owe their being. They carry a tie in which they are linked to their principles, and by this line, men might have conduct through the labyrinth of the universe to the first cause. Secondly, another rule is given. Live according to nature. This sounds harsh, and it is, because it is in the mother language of those who have never heard of Christ. But a good interpreter will easily help the business. There is in all men an implanted inclination to happiness, and a home-born pilot to carry this in a right course. But it is true, though the former is perfect, yet the latter is not. A man is another thing than he was. The soul is quick of foot, but dull of scent. Her sails are strong, but her compass is marred. The practical judgment, the soul's navigator, is dim-sighted, mistaking rocks for harbors, and sea for land, west for east, and earth for heaven. But herein is man's great unhappiness. God has opened a way to renew those blurred characters of knowledge which yet remain as the light in the air after sunset, but man disregards it. The scriptures are given by inspiration of God to make wise unto salvation. But men are so far from duly seeking to enlighten that glimmering snuff of natural understanding at this fountain of light, that they are in love with their own darkness. They hate the light because their deeds are evil, John chapter 3, verse 20. Eroding the power of conscience, or a check to their lusts, they restrict it, whereas they should rectify conscience by the word, and affections by conscience. They perversely cast off conscience to give way to sin. Yea, from a grave counselor, they turn it into a base flatterer to applaud their greatest folly and wickedness. But what will the end be? Shall God come again with tenders of mercy and a new league of friendship, and shall man hang off? Those to whom God has come with many gracious visits and potent workings, yet they come not in. Let them especially consider this. I did purpose and promise in the beginning of this treatise to speak of God's leaving such, but I lack the opportunity at present. I say no more now to them but this. It is dangerous to despise grace and to resist the Spirit. If he departs, woe be unto you. Your latter end will pay you for your folly and pridefulness. The day is coming in which God will follow after foolish man no more. Wonder at his patience that has waited on the world some thousands of years already. But this long-lasting patience has fixed its period. Blessed are they that enjoy him. But as for all the rest, adieu forever. Then God will depart fully and eternally. It shall be no more said, come, but then go, ye accursed, into everlasting fire. Matthew 25, verse 41. Now you have your choice. Here is God and the world. But this is folly. Men take that in a disjunctive sense, which is offered in a conjunctive. It is not said God or the world, but God and the world. In some consideration, indeed, they are decided, but most make the wrong choice. Here begins that vast distance between the saints and the wicked. They set out at first from one point, but more diverse, yea, adverse ways, according to the difference of their ends. A godly man, when he first chooses God, becomes a happy man. This is because his choice is the guide which sets all the wheels in a right motion. Love is as the wing to the fowl, or as the oars to the boat, which move it and order it. When this is done, God and man are brought together. This sweet meeting and amiable conjunction is a great part of the plot of that eternal love of God which chose us, that we might be made happy by answering his choice of us with our choice of him, that he may dwell in us and we in him. 1 John chapter 3, verse 24. I think this world is like the king's court. Children here are taken with pictures and feed their eyes and fancies with hangings and fine things. But the wise and the grave statesman passes by these. His business is with the king. Most men stay in the outer rooms and loathings of the world, and so are mean. But blessed is the generation whose eye, desire, and way are unto God. The creature is not capable of a higher blessedness than to have God for his God. They that dwell in God have a true dwelling. Men who live upon the creature do not dwell, but roll as ships at sea, or travel as wandering vagrants. In God there is quiet abode and perfect rest, for here is no evil nor want of God. Here is enough, and such as may fit all times and conditions, all occasions, soul and body, fully. Here in these depths are wonders for the mind to feed on. Here also is a sea room of goodness for the vast appetite of man to float in. And the satiety of the appetite breeds all repose and joy. Oh, the delectableness of this condition! Is this a depth of riches, deep riches that cannot be sounded, and rich depths that cannot be exhausted? Christ is the blessed channel between the fountain and the cistern, through which grace, life, peace, strength, and glory come by a gracious and glorious convoy. It is in every vessel, or in it, every vessel shall have its fullness to all eternity. Sometimes, indeed, while this life lasts, the streams come fuller and sometimes slower. Sometimes Christ saves the current that we may thirst, so that after thirsting we may drink again with redoubled pleasure. This is the principal part of a godly man's unhappiness, that he has neither a full nor fixed state of comfortable communion with God in the world. After sweet meetings comes sad partings. Nothing is fixed. There is a flood and ebb as well on land as in the sea, and as well in things spiritual as in things natural. Even those that are the strongest knit have a time of parting. Nothing in nature is more conjunct than its own frame, yet this compacted composition admits of dissolution. Man, the epitome of the world, is in this case. Soul and body one day will shake hands, yea, and the body will fall asunder from itself. Those four elements that come in a vital league will go out again with a deadly war. The tie between God and the soul is the firmest thing in the world. The bond of grace is stronger than the bond of nature. Yet even here is a kind of parting also. But as the conjunction is stronger, so the separation is less. But sometimes it is so great that the saints, by enforcement of sorrow, cry out, "My God hath forsaken me, my Lord hath forgotten me." This sad condition is the subject of this little treatise, concerning which I would have put here some advertisements, but my pen has deceived me and has led me out into a larger and other way than I intended in this preface. Nothing more is now to be done but to leave this small help in the hands of such whose souls long after the return of God, with quickening and comforting influences upon them. Joseph Simmons. Chapter 1. Sometimes the godly suffer desertion. Most men, since God and they parted in Adam, live without God in the world, Ephesians chapter 2, verses 12 and 13, and are so far from him that they neither enjoy him nor know him. Yet there is a generation of men whom God has brought near by the blood of Christ, with whom he has renewed that old acquaintance and amity which at the first he had with them, and they with him. This blessed estate, as it is not here perfected, so it is often interrupted. Their comforts are sweet always, but short often. There are but few, if any, whose joys in a comfortable communion with God are not sometimes clouded with sorrows and doleful elongation from him, so that if you lay but your ear to the door of their closets, you shall often hear the daughters of Zion, as heirs of their mother's miseries, complaining in their mother's language, "The Lord hath forsaken me, and my God hath forgotten me." Isaiah 49, verse 14. If you fix your eyes upon them, you shall see Zion's ears in their eyes, her paleness in their faces, her sorrows in their souls. In consideration of and compassion to these mourners, I shall spend some thoughts upon this sad subject. Desertions are either common or special. These which I call common are such as all men share in by nature, God having forsaken and withdrawn himself from Adam and all his posterity, as well as from the apostate angels. The special I shall handle as they concern the godly, or hypocrites. Desertions, as they concern men who are truly regenerate, are God's withdrawing of himself in respect of quickening, quieting, or comforting of the soul. Desertions, as they concern men seemingly regenerate, are God's withholding of those influences by which they had a special or a spiritual kind of life and comfort. To begin, then, with desertions as they concern the godly, I shall first speak something in general of them, and then descend to the more particulars. That which I shall say in the general I will comprise in two things. Number one, that there is such an evil as spiritual desertion, chapter 1. Number two, how they are deserted, chapter 2. Yet there is such an estate it is almost lost labor to prove. Yet, as all in Christians is hidden and secret, so nothing is more hidden than their comforts and discomforts. I will, and that in two words, make it good. We will call in two witnesses to give evidence to the truth. First, the experience of the saints. Ask Zion, and you shall have her verdict. And Zion said, "The Lord has forsaken me, and my God hath forgotten me." Isaiah 49, verse 14. You see here the church clad in all black, bewailing her widowhood as one bereft of her dearest husband. Every word of her speech is bedewed with tears and bears a drop from her bleeding soul. The Lord Jehovah, he whose power and fidelity has been to me as the pillars of the earth, he has forsaken me. He has cast me off. My Lord, he who was mine in covenant, mine in communion, he who was the joy of my life, the life of my joy, the strength, the stay, the spring of my life, he has forgotten me. He has cast me not only out of his arms, but out of his heart. I am quite out of his love, not only forsaken, but forgotten. And in this, Zion is not alone. Ask David, and you shall hear him as soon as you come near him, sighing, sobbing, crying, roaring. But what does he say? What ails him? He tells you, my God, why have you forsaken me? Psalm 22, verse 1. See how well their testimony agrees. How can a man look upon David and not count him as a poor orphan that is left in a woeful case, friendless, helpless, comfortless? But yet we will hear from one greater than David, that is, the captain of our salvation, the first and head of the whole order. And we will go no further to ask of others than what he says. David here was a type of Christ, and as himself, but of the shadow of Christ's person. So was his sorrow, but a shadow of Christ's sorrow. David did but taste of the cup which Christ afterward drank more deeply of, when in the anguish of his soul upon the cross he cried out, my God, why have you forsaken me? Matthew 27, verse 46. And this cup has gone around ever since, so that few have ever tasted of the waters of life, but they have drunk also of these waters of Marah. The experience of almost all the saints contributes to the evidence of this truth. Where shall we find a man that has not met with these rocks and sands that has not seen some gloomy days and winter storms. We all pass through many changes, sometimes rejoicing as the plants in the spring and the silent sense of God's gracious preference, and sometimes mourning for our loss of God. Sometimes we are lifted up to heaven in our souls, mounting, as it were, on eagle's wings. At other times we are depressed to the depths of hell and held as with chains of brass or iron. At one moment we are quickened, but soon after growing dull again. Few can say they have once found God who do not also say they have often lost him. Second, add to the experience of the saints the witness of God himself. David, Haman, Job, and Zion might speak much out of distrust, impatience, passion, and so forth. But when God himself shall come in to confirm their evidence, which is past doubt, or it is past doubt. For does Zion bewail herself as a widow, forlorn without a husband? God said it was so. The Lord hath called thee as a woman forsaken, and grieved in spirit, and a wife of youth, when thou wast refused, saith God. Isaiah 54, verse 6. God said he had, in a sense, divorced himself from her. Yea, and whereas Zion complained that God had forsaken her, it is no more than God said himself, for a small moment I have forsaken thee. That's verse 7. Therefore it is shown that sometimes the sad portion of the saints is to be deserted. And this I have spoken, that the mourners in Zion may see that this uncomfortable state may consist with grace. It is a comfort to know that thy depths are passable and thy case curable. Others have walked in this heavy way and are now in heaven. Others have been in these storms, yet have safely arrived at the land of promise. None other affliction hath befallen, yea, but that which is common to men. 1 Corinthians 10, verse 13. Therefore, do not be overwhelmed in grief, or give thyself up as lost. Disquietness will hurt, but it cannot help. Rather, stir yourself up to take hold of God. Repent, pray, believe, and wait. For God is faithful and will not suffer you to be tempted above that you are able, but will with the temptation also make a way to escape, that you may be able to bear it. Verse 13, part B.